Hello, I'm Terrence McNally, and welcome to today's podcast. Last July, in an interview with Charlie Rose, President Obama said that, quote, the mistake of the early years of his presidency was his failure to be a better storyteller. I'm going to quote him. The mistake of my first couple of years was thinking that this job was just about getting the policy right. And that's important. But the nature of this office is also to tell a story to the American people that gives them a sense of unity and purpose and optimism, especially during tough times. In a second term, he said, he would, quote, spend more time with the American people, listening to them, but also being in a conversation with them about where do we go as a country. This next hour is not going to be primarily about Obama or about politics. It's about story and narrative. My guest is Jonathan Gottschall, author of a new book, The Storytelling Animal, How Stories Make Us Human. My website, for any of you who ever checked it out, is aworldthatjustmightwork.com. But if you go to the homepage, you see this quote. On the radio, I tell stories of a world that just might work, and as a consultant, I help you tell yours. Full disclosure, after time as a teacher, 2 decades in the entertainment industry, 15 years of radio interviews, I now work with nonprofits, foundations, public agencies, and some businesses to help them tell better stories and build better narratives. And I'm eager to learn from Jonathan what science has to tell us about this. Why is story so powerful? What can we do with what we're learning so that we can tap even more of the power of narrative? Okay, we're sitting around the fire, eating prime rib of mammoth. Life is good. Nobody asks for a PowerPoint. They ask for the story. And as Og and Nog tell how they tracked and trapped and killed and dragged dinner home, that story not only celebrates their prowess, which of course it does, but it also teaches everyone around that campfire lessons and skills that will make them all more likely to survive as individuals and as a family or a tribe. We evolved looking for narrative. The late evolutionary biologist Stephen Jay Gould called humans the primate who tells stories. And it's not just Gould. I've heard that anthropologists have found societies that have existed for millennia without the wheel, but they've never found a society that doesn't tell stories. Jonathan Gottschall teaches English at Washington and Jefferson College and writes at the intersection of science and art. His work has been featured in the New York Times, Scientific American Mind, New Scientist, Nature, Science, and on NPR. His blog, The Storytelling Animal, is featured at psychologytoday.com. And his books include The Rape of Troy and his latest, The Storytelling Animal. And you can learn more at jonathangottschall.com. And that's Jonathan, J-O-N-A-T-H-A-N, Gottschall, G-O-T-T-S-C-H-A-L-L. One word, jonathangottschall.com. Welcome, Jonathan Gottschall.
Oh, thank you for having me on. I appreciate it.
Okay, I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind any of the ideas and the work that we're going to talk about. So tell us a bit about your path to the work that you do today, that writing at the intersection of culture and art, I mean of art and science. Feel free to mention mentors, turning points, moments of decision, that sort of thing.
Okay, I started out as a literary scholar, so at 21 or so I went to graduate school in English, and by 22 or so I was pretty frustrated with the state of affairs over in English departments. There seemed to be this vicious cycle that we were stuck in, where we kind of were chasing our tails and we were never really figuring anything out. We'd argue and argue and argue and never really come to any sort of conclusion about things. And so I started sniffing around for a way of doing this investigation into literature that you would allow you to reach more stable and secure results. And the model that seemed to work pretty well in other fields was the scientific method. And so I started to see in my own research, you know, how far I could get by stealing data from the sciences and stealing theories from the sciences and stealing the sort of empirical methods of the sciences. And so that's where my sort of research was oriented, and that's where the current book comes out of, that sort of attempt to see how far we can get by applying scientific models to literary or fictional humanities-based problems.
Hmm, interesting. And so let me ask you, by the way, am I right about my historical picture? Have they ever found a society that doesn't tell stories?
I don't believe so. I don't believe so. I mean, it's even more impressive than that, I think. I think, you know, people have a tendency to be distracted by what's been called ethnographic dazzle. It's this idea, like, you know, like how you look around the world, and people seem so different, their culture seems so different, and their art seems so different. But if you get beneath those surfaces, you find a lot of similarity. So it's not only that we haven't identified any cultures, any societies that lack stories. It's that we find that their stories are just like ours. They focus on protagonists struggling against obstacles to achieve their desires. And the obstacles are always big things, you know, about sex and death and power. So you find this incredible regularity across cultures.
Yeah, I mean, as you were saying that, I was thinking of Joseph Campbell's The Hero of a Thousand Faces.
Absolutely, yeah. So I suppose my work is in that basic tradition.
Yeah, so anyone who doesn't know this, Campbell went and looked at all the sort of creation stories and the myths of that backed up religions and beliefs around the world, and found cultures that had never had geographical contact with each other, and yet the stories were the same over and over and over again. And as you said, also very similar to, let's say, the children's story, hero, villain, conflict,
yeah,
et cetera,
yeah.
And the Hollywood screenwriting class.
Absolutely. Yeah, I go so far as in the book to call this the universal grammar of storytelling. You find it in fiction. You find it in Hollywood screenplays. You find it in children's make-believe. You even find it in the stories we spontaneously create when we're dreaming. And the universal grammar is something I call problem structure. Yeah, stories are always about problems. And again, this is kind of seems obvious in some ways, especially if you've taken Fiction 101 and taken a screenwriting class. But in other ways, it's not obvious at all. If you're like a Martian anthropologist or a Martian literary scholar, and you knew humans had this weird ability to teleport themselves into any kind of imaginative universe that they wanted, you probably would suspect that they'd teleport into universes, into alternative realities where everything went well, where things were nice, where their wishes were fulfilled. But overwhelmingly, the dominant pattern is that we don't. We teleport into worlds of suffering and lack and woe. The story world is a dangerous place. It's a threatening place. And it goes for, again, it goes for fiction, it goes for children's make-believe, and it goes for the world of dreams.
Yeah, just to jump into that for a second, you've talked about what you've even noticed in your own children.
Yeah, oh yeah, yeah. I mean, one of the things, I just got lucky to some extent writing the book that my own little children, I have two little girls, were about 4 and 7 during the main period that I was working on the book. And that is all around the world, no matter where you come from, that is the golden age of children's make-believe. And so they were just spending all of their times in these wonder worlds, you know, of mommies and daddies and good guys and bad guys. And I would observe and watch from the outside and actually learn quite a bit. And one of the things that really struck me was just how dark these fantasy worlds are. So maybe like a couple months ago, just to give an example,
yeah.
You know, I'm out on the back deck and my 6-year-old, the 4-year-old is now 6, her little friend comes over and they embrace and they say, you want to play? And they say, well, what do you want to play? And my daughter says, let's pretend our parents are dead. And, you know, and boom, I'm dead. And I got, you know, eaten by tigers, as it turned out. And, you know, and they're running around in the backyard, fleeing and fighting from these imaginary dangers, and just having a wonderful time doing it. But the scenario is incredibly dark. You know, the scenario is one where their loving parents and protectors are gone, and they really have to fend for themselves in an extremely dangerous world. And that's more the norm in children's pretend play than not. We have a nostalgic and fundamentally inaccurate view of what kids play is like. We think of it as tend to be, you know, sort of like a sunny, heavenly Buddyland. But it's not like that at all. Wonderland is a pretty dark place.
Yeah. No, I love the fact that it wasn't that they were had anything against you personally, that they were killing you. It's that, that's the way they could really become the heroes.
That's right. That's a good point. Yeah. Yeah. A hero needs a big struggle.
That's right. And as long as you guys are around, you know, it's not the same story. It's got, this
true.
Way, it's their story.
That's right. That's absolutely right.
We've sort of framed it, but usually something goes into this sort of thing. So why do you call your blog and your book The Storytelling Animal?
There's an old, old, old debate about what makes a human a human. Like, what sets us apart most fundamentally from the rest of creation? You know, humans have a sense of ourselves as special. But what is it, above all, that makes us special? And when we name ourselves Homo sapien, we're making an argument. And the argument is that it's human sapience, it's our intelligence, it's our wisdom that really sets us apart from the rest of creation. It's our big brains. But other people say, well, you know, other scientists, other scholars, other philosophers say, well, you know, we're actually not all that wise. We're often pretty irrational, pretty illogical. And so maybe it's upright posture that really sets us apart, or it's our opposable thumbs and the sophisticated tool use, or maybe it's culture, or maybe it's language. And so the point of the book is not to deny any of those things, or even to downgrade them. It's just to say that one other really important thing tends to get left off that list, and that's storytelling. The way that we live the majority of our lives inside various kinds of story. So Homo sapiens, that's pretty good, a pretty accurate characterization. But Homo fictus, fiction man, which is what I call us in the book, is about equally as good.
And you say that we spend more time in the realm of fantasy than we actually do in the real world. Neverland is our evolutionary niche, our special habitat. How is that so, and what does that mean?
Well, this is one of the things that surprised me in my own research was, you know, I knew story was important, of course, that's why I wrote the book, but the more I got into it, the more I was sort of shocked by this realization that people aren't really Earthlings. We don't really live here on Earth. We spend some time here on Earth, but for the most part, we're voyaging in Neverland. So if you start just adding up the hours, you know, so the average American spends 4 or 5 hours per day watching TV or watching DVDs. The average American reads about a half hour a day. Some of the time is fiction time. The average American listens to about 5 hours of songs per day. Sometimes it's in the background, not paying much attention. It's elevator music, whatever. But a lot of these songs are story-based songs. Then you have daydreams, these little stories that we're constantly spinning in our head. About one-third of our lives on Earth, amazingly, is daydreaming, about 8 hours per day.
Let me just, for anyone who just, you know, didn't quite hear that, you're not talking about night dreaming.
I'm not, no.
Night dreaming is in addition to 8 hours of daydreaming a day.
Yeah, so the most conservative estimates suggest that we daydream about night dream about 2 hours per night in a vivid, continuous, story-like way. That's about 6 years out of your lifespan. And when it comes to daydreaming, so, you know, we think about, okay, we wake up, we don't dream anymore, but actually we're dreaming all day long. The average daydream is about 14 seconds long. We have about 2,000 of them per day. The mind is just constantly flitting around in Neverland, making up the stories, living inside them. Whenever we don't have something really important to do, like, you know, like give an interview like this, like I'm not going to daydream during this interview, but probably the listeners will, you know, every now and then you fade out. So you add up all these hours of daydreams, night dreams, conventional fiction, and so on and so forth, and you get an estimate that suggests that we're spending more time in story worlds than we're spending in the real world.
Okay, that suggests two questions to me. The one of them you probably have a specific answer to. The other one is, do you think this was always true? In other words, as it turns out, X number of hours that you just talked about has to do with tools, that is, screens, books, etc.,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Music.
Yeah.
When indigenous tribes, do we have any sense what their division is between Neverland and quote, reality?
My guess is they're still spending more time in Neverland, but it's mainly because of the spontaneous forms of story that their minds are creating, daydreams and night dreams. Story, as you're suggesting, we're living in an incredibly story-rich habitat now. Stories are all around us. They're at our fingertips. I walk around with my little iPod that has all these songs on it, all these books on tape on it. And so story used to be scarce. In order to get a story, for most of human history, you had to find a skilled teller and get him or her to sit down and tell you a story. So there's certainly more of it now than there used to be. But I think humans have always been creatures of story.
Yeah, I mean, the oldest, that is to say, in terms of culture or what I'm talking about, indigenous folks I've ever dealt with was I spent a little time with the Ashuar in the Amazon. And their practice is to wake up before dawn and share their dreams.
Oh, cool.
And that is, and I don't think that's unique among that particular tribe. I think that the value of story as a resource was something that they tapped in a way long before all these screens showed up.
Oh, that's really interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Let me, the other question was, how do we know, how did they study, how did they find out that we're daydreaming all the time and that the average one is 14 seconds? How do they do that?
Oh, that's a great question, yeah. So daydreams are really hard to study scientifically because they're so interior, right? And so the way they've studied this is they basically give people beepers and they give them diaries. And every now and then they just harass them, they beep them, and when you get that beep, you're supposed to, and then the beep says, quick, stop whatever you're doing right now. And write down whatever was in your head. And so they had people basically keep a daydream diary. And there's been multiple studies of this, all converging on the same basic result, about 8 hours per day, which means, you know, that essentially the daydream is the mind's default state.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking, default, yeah.
Yeah, it's what the mind is doing whenever it doesn't have something really important to do.
And for people who are thinking that means, you know, often in the, you know, distant realms, it also means I wonder how the traffic's going to be when I come around the next curve, right? I mean, it's that kind of daydream as well. If I have this phone call, I wonder how what I should say. I mean, some of it's of that sort, right?
Some of it's really mundane.
Yeah, oh, I know.
You're going to work, and you're like, well, I wonder if I, you know, what would happen if I took this road versus the tunnel. You know, how you know, what would be the scenario? How is that scenario likely to play out? But other times the daydreams are, you know, very movie-like, you know, these vivid fantasies that we screen in the theaters of our mind, you know, when all of our secret, dirty, vain, smutty wishes come true, or when all of our nightmares are realized.
If we put together a few things we've said so far, which is that perhaps counterintuitively much of our dreaming is trouble, is jeopardy. Much of our storytelling is trouble and jeopardy. How does story serve a biological function? And what does this tendency to have stories be about trouble have to do with that?
Okay, so this is a really difficult and important question. You know, what if anything is a biological function of story? And there's a couple caveats I need to start with. One is, we don't know for sure. There's been very little concerted research on this until maybe the last decade, and it's a difficult problem. The second point is that story could be for a lot of things. It could be, you know, if you look at your hand is not for one thing. It's for all kinds of different things. It was shaped by evolution to do multiple jobs. It's not a single-purpose tool like a hammer. It's a multi-purpose tool, right, like a Swiss Army knife. And story could be the same way. It could be shaped by multiple evolutionary forces for multiple evolutionary purposes. That said, one idea is that, you know, you find this form, that fiction has a certain form. And the question is, can you jump from the form of fiction, problem structure, to a theory about a possible function? And multiple people, dream researchers, scholars, psychologists who study fiction, have been sort of independently converging on this idea that stories might be for simulation, for problem simulation. So in the same way like a pilot will strap into a flight simulator to practice up on the big dilemmas of flying a plane, maybe we go into fiction worlds to get the same sort of practice, so we get to see what it would be like to seduce someone's spouse or confront a powerful man, and we don't die at the end. The hero of the story dies in our stead. So you get the benefit of practice without the costs And there's actually some research on this. There's actually been some experimental findings to back this up, suggesting that people who consume a lot of stories tend to outperform heavy nonfiction consumers in tests of things like empathy and various social skills, all leading to this idea that maybe story is, again, about getting practice, getting vicarious experience, learning to do better at real-world problems by practicing on these simulated problems.
Yeah, let me just read a quote from David Eagleman. This is from his review of your book in the New York Times, and David's been a guest on this show in the past. Neuroscience has long recognized that emulation of the future is one of the main businesses intelligent brains invest in. By learning the rules of the world and simulating outcomes in the service of decision-making, brains can play out events without the risk and the expense of attempting them physically, which I thought was just a nice way of putting it.
I think so, too. Yeah, David's very good at summing things up.
Yeah. Well, he even had that fiction book he wrote that has won prizes. So
yeah, he's a champ.
It's nice when science folks can write as well, yeah.
Yeah, he's impressive.
So here's one that goes to all of this. Can our brains know the difference between reality and story? And how is it that we seem to be as moved by fiction as by reality, even when we know it's fiction? What's going on in that?
Yeah, this is really cool, too, I think. There's this great ad campaign that I've seen for the movie series Paranormal Experience. Do you know it? It's a Paranormal Activity, excuse me. Paranormal Activity is a horror film franchise. And they had this great sort of contagious ad campaign that showed screenings of the film. And instead of watching what was happening on the film, they turned the camera around and watched the audience. And it's just amazing to see these people who know that blood is only ketchup and who know there's no real monster, it's just light playing on a screen, reacting in terror. They're absolutely horrified. They're jumping out of their seats. They're flinching. They're screaming. They're jumping into each other's laps. And so what's going on there? Why do smart people who know this is all an illusion react to it as though it's real? And so there's actually been some kind of neat science on this. And they've been studying brains on fiction. They slide you into an fMRI machine, and they basically expose you to fiction when you're inside the fMRI machine. And the short of it is that when you look at the brain on fiction, it looks like the brain is acting not like a spectator, not like some cool, detached observer, but the brain looks like a participant in the action. So when Clint Eastwood is angry on the screen, the brain looks like it's actually angry, too. And when the scene is sad, the brain actually looks sad also. So the power of fiction comes, it seems, at least in part, from this fact that what is happening on the page or on the stage isn't just happening to that character. It's actually happening to us. It's happening to our brains as well. Our unconscious brains are processing it as real, even if our conscious brains know it's fake.
Wow. And so it taps the emotions. It gets down to some of our things about meaning and value and so on happens in this fictional, right? We are influenced by the fictions that we're surrendering to.
That's right.
Yeah, what's the theory on why that happens? Because it seems, if you're just being Mr. Totally Rational, that would be a problem. that would not be a positive thing, that you would keep falling for things and schizophrenics, right, are folks who have multiple realities.
Right, right. Well, yeah, there's people that believe fiction is not for anything in biological terms, that it just kind of happened. It's just kind of lucky accident of the way the brain happens to be organized. And there's those of us who believe, well, on our consultation of the evidence, it seems to be that it looks more plausible to us that this does have a biological function. So for people who are functionalists, who believe that story is for something in biological terms, there's a reason that humans do it, have always done it, do it everywhere in the world, do it as children, do it in their dreams, do it in their sleep, it must be for something. And so they're tempted to see this as part of the design of story, as part of the design of the mind. So the unconscious, you get this training, this very vivid, very realistic. But your unconscious, your conscious mind then does reassert itself and say, wait, this is fake. Okay, don't get carried away. So what's cool about those paranormal experience videos I was talking
right,
about?
Right, right, right.
Is a person jumps out of their seat, they cringe in their seat, and then very often the next reaction is laughter. And they're not laughing at what happened on the screen because that was there's a mutilation that occurred on the screen.
Right.
What they're doing is they're laughing sheepishly at themselves.
Sure, they were caught. They're embarrassed by how they fell for it.
Yeah, they totally fell for it. So your mind reacts unconsciously as though there's really a zombie attacking you.
Yeah.
But then the conscious mind reasserts itself, says, "Hey, wait, relax. This isn't really happening."
You know, that just reminded me, and my brain makes associations. But my dog gets excited. We're going on a walk, gets excited about a dog nearby, and suddenly goes into, you know, you can see the whole body changes, and maybe there's some barking. You know, he's getting better, she's getting better, but what happens is once we get past that stimulus, she shakes it off. It seems like it's a similar thing that happens to us in that moment of laughing.
We're sort of
shaking ourselves back to reality.
Right. Good point.
Building on this, the fact that we experience fiction, I'm going to read you a couple of things you wrote. One is that results repeatedly show that our attitudes, fears, hopes, and values are strongly influenced by story. Okay, in fact, fiction seems to be more effective at changing beliefs than writing that is specifically designed to persuade through argument and evidence. That is powerful stuff. Talk about that.
Yeah, again, I'm a story guy. That's why I got into this book. But this result surprised me. This is one of the things that surprised me. Let's go back to Tolstoy. So Tolstoy, at the end of the 19th century, writes a book called What is Art? And he's asking this really basic. He was an adventurous thinker, and he's asking this really basic, important question. You know, what is art, and why do we like it so much? And he comes to this very simple conclusion, and I love it. He defines art, including story art, in fact, especially story art, is what he was thinking about the most. He defines story art as an infection. The idea of story art for Tolstoy is to infect the audience with the storyteller's ideas and the storyteller's emotions. And the better the story, the more infectious it is. The more infectious the ideas are, the more infectious the emotions are. And, you know, fast forward 100 years or more, and basically that's what they're finding in the psychology lab as well. So to sum it up, basically what appears to be happening is that when people experience sort of dry, non-fictional, essayistic arguments, they're critical, they're skeptical, they have their guards up, they dig in their heels, they know you're trying to persuade them of something, and they resist. But when they're exposed to an emotionally absorbing story, it seems to make us soft. We let our guards down, and we become easy to mold and to manipulate. So, yeah, I mean, there's just a ton of research that's been showing over and over again that people reliably change their views towards values, attitudes, behaviors, etc., in a way that's consistent with the direction of the story.
Wow. And if I go back to the thing I mentioned at the top, which was Obama's realization that he would have done a better job by telling a better story, you can really see this comes into play. I mean, he, as we saw, great storyteller in his books, great storyteller in the 08 campaign, a facts and figures guy, a rational, cool rationalist for so much of the first two terms.
Right.
And he just gave away what you're saying is the thing that actually, that what you want to do. Now, of course, as you can hear, the other side of this, folks, is this is, again, danger, because it means that the story and the storyteller and so on has a great deal of power. You tell a couple of stories in there, stories about the power of story. And just briefly, if you would, Hitler's experience of Wagner's opera, and the experience let's say, our entire nation and some of Europe had to Uncle Tom's Cabin.
Yeah, so what the research shows and what the sort of historical studies show is that fiction stories, they're very powerful. They're very powerful. It shapes beliefs, shape attitudes, shape values, sometimes on a mass scale. What they don't show is that story is always for the good. So a master storyteller is using story as a tool to get what he or she deserves, to achieve whatever infection they want to plant in us. So the sort of most standard story about the good side of story would be Uncle Tom's Cabin. So in 1852, Harriet Beecher Stowe writes this novel, Uncle Tom's Cabin. And in 1862, Lincoln has her to the White House, and he says to her, "So you're the little woman who wrote the book that made this great war." And so he's flattering her a little bit. He's overstating the case a little bit. But historians agree that, you know, she roused abolitionist sympathies strongly in the North, and that Uncle Tom was one of the instigating factors that brought on the Civil War and brought on the abolition of slavery. But then you fast forward another 50 years and you find that you're in a theater in North Carolina where a Southern preacher named Thomas Dixon is squirming miserably through a theatrical performance of Uncle Tom's Cabin. And he leaves and he's infuriated, and he decides he's going to tell the real story of race relations in America. He's going to tell the real story of after the Civil War. And he writes a novel called The Klansman. It's published in 1905 and it's a huge bestseller. And in 1915, it's made into an epic film, and an epically successful film called The Birth of a Nation, which inflames race relations in a really negative way and is kind of not single-handedly, but close to single-handedly responsible for the resurrection of an almost defunct KKK. So you can follow the course just to this one story, Uncle Tom's Cabin,
yeah,
and show where it's producing really wonderful effects in some ways, and then kind of gets twisted and causes really awful suffering from another perspective.
Mm-hmm. And the Hitler?
Oh, yeah, Hitler, yes. Yeah, so Hitler is 16 years old, and he goes to this opera, and the opera is called Rienzi. And Hitler, most people don't know this, but he was a big art guy. You know, he loved art, and he loved opera above all. He was a real opera... he was a real opera fanatic.
It's funny to hear fanatic. Yes, we know that part.
Yeah,
go ahead.
So he's sitting in the audience. He's 16 years old, and he's shattered by the beauty of this performance. And he goes out into the streets, and he walks the streets until midnight, and he tells his friend that he's had an epiphany, that he is going to be the one to lead his people out of despair and to the heights of freedom and prosperity. And this is a story that guides him through the rest of his life. He tells the story over and over again about how he saw Rienzi, and that was where it all began, he tells his friends. That was the beginning of the process that turned this really unpromising boy into the great leader of the Nazi party. And so some people had taken this argument a long way. They said, if not for Wagner, if not for this moment, Hitler would have never been Hitler. I don't think you can say that. But it is interesting to speculate about what role this had in shaping his character. Hitler would say things like, if you want to understand the Nazi party, if you want to understand what we're about, you must understand the works of Wagner.
Yeah, no, it's very powerful, very powerful, that, and I think, yeah, most people don't know that piece. Now, one thing you say I had a little trouble with. You say that for a story, and this goes back a little bit to where we're talking about in the past about trouble and problems and so on, but you say that for a story to work, it has to possess a particular morality.
Mm-hmm.
To capture an influence, it can't be plagued with moral repugnance. It can't be where some does horrible things and wins.
Yeah.
If the narrative doesn't contain the suitable kind of virtue, our brains don't absorb it. Now, I'm sure I can think of counterexamples. So talk a bit about that.
Yeah. I fold this into my discussion of universal grammar. So the idea that there's a universal grammar of problem structure, that's a very strong tendency in world fiction. It's very hard to come up with really strong counterexamples, to come up with any example of a story that isn't focused around a problem. If you find an example of a story like that, it tends to be something avant-garde that a lot of people just really don't like to watch very much, or to see very much, or to read very much.
Right, and just let me cut in for a sec. This is what you get in any screenplay writing course. You will be taught,
absolutely,
here's the ones that work, and yes, occasionally there's a Baghdad Cafe, and occasionally there's a Wim Wenders film, but if you want to get your film sold, produced, and people see it, stick to this formula.
Absolutely, yeah. And you have, you know, basically the same thing with the moral structure of fiction. For the most part, you have something called poetic justice, where good guys and bad guys get what they deserve. The morality play structure is always has been and still is the dominant pattern in fiction. Sometimes the bad guys do win, but we know at the end that it's a tragedy. And the bad values, the sort of values of selfishness or hatred or greed, are never held up and celebrated, right? So a story can almost be seen as a way, a sort of vehicle for conveying a certain message. So in screenplay class, they say, oh, it's got to have a conflict, it's got to have a problem, and so forth. But if the story doesn't have a sort of moral dimension to it, an ethical dimension, some sort of value or idea that's being communicated, it seems just like empty storytelling to us. We want it to have some sort of larger point.
And so the stickiness of it will be influenced by that. In other words, you're saying the overcome an obstacle, but it doesn't matter. There's no moral dimension. There's no redemption. There's no good versus evil, and it won't stick as much?
I don't think so.
Mm-hmm.
Just off the top of my head, you know, you think about Moby Dick. Moby Dick, you know, if it was just about a deranged sperm whale smashing up boats and chomping up sailors, it wouldn't be the great American novel. You know, it's because all that action, all that trouble is about conveying deeper messages, this deeper idea about the nature of man and the nature of evil. That's what makes it so sticky.
Yeah. Now, let me just say, And my guess is there's a lot of listeners saying this as well. I remember one day after the Oscars one year, I was riding in a rental car, and I asked the young man who brought me my rental car, what did you think? Did you think it should have been Brokeback Mountain or Crash, right? And he said, oh, my favorite movies this year were Saw. Now, what I'm saying is Saw is a whole series, very successful, makes a ton of money.
Yes.
People go see it. Yes. My guess is that there's no there's not much moral lesson in Saw. So these are just the exceptions.
Yeah.
These are just the exceptions that prove the rule.
Well, have you seen the films?
I haven't.
Yeah, I actually went to see one of these.
Oh,
films.
Good.
I went and saw Saw in Saw 4 in 3D. So there was wet bags of guts like flying into the audience. It was unbelievable. Now, what's interesting about the Saw films, and I'm not an authority on them, but there is a moral structure.
Oh, good. Okay.
You know, for the most part, the people being tortured kind of deserve it in a lot of ways.
Okay, a little bit like Dexter.
Yes. The killer is a moralist. He's an extreme moralist.
Okay.
Who's torturing people for various, you know, he's going too far for dang,
right,
dang sure. But your larger point is, you know, how is it that you can say story is moral when story is so chock full of such breathtaking lewdness and depravity and awfulness?
Shock effect, that sort of thing. Yeah.
Well, yeah, and it's true. The subject matter of fiction, in large part, is people behaving badly.
Mm-hmm.
And so moralists have often glommed onto that to say that, well, obviously then this is degrading the moral structure of society. But they leave out the fact that fiction is also almost overwhelmingly about the condemnation of that bad behavior.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And oftentimes, usually in fact, about the punishment of that behavior.
Yeah.
And that goes for high literature, and it goes for schlock. You know, it goes for romance novels and crappy TV shows like Knight Rider.
Well, if you remember that the Hays Code in Hollywood for decades, people remember it as being about sex, but it wasn't just about sex. It was that bad guys had to lose. Good people had to win. If you had sex out of marriage, you had to get hurt by it. And if you made a movie that the script didn't do that, you were censored.
Right.
So, very strong. I'm speaking with Jonathan Gottschall. We're talking about his book, The Storytelling Animal. I'm Terrence McNally. This is Free Forum. This is KPFK. I got a couple of other big ones. One is this. When I'm teaching people about story and narrative and so on, I'm going to read you a little piece of something I say, and I want to know if you think I'm on the right track.
Okay.
I emphasize, if you're going to become a better storyteller, I emphasize the crucial role of listening to others and to yourself. And I believe that we need to breathe, we need to be present so that our hearts are engaged when we're telling the story, so that the story is alive and that it's actually co-created in that moment with the audience or with our listener as our partner. And I go back to what we talked about earlier, that stories emerged under the sky, around campfires, that a story is not a static, dead, solitary thing. And I suspect that in some ways the essential nature of narrative has to do with it being shared. Now, we've talked about it being this rumination that goes on in the background always to help us solve problems. But what about this nature of narrative that the delivery of a story is about the interaction?
That's really interesting. So, I don't know. I mean, I guess I'll ask you a question first.
Sure.
Before I answer. What do you mean? Like, how would that interaction be happening in something like a novel or a film, where there's a separation between the teller and the audience?
Okay. I will jump back to then. This is a bit metaphorical, because of course that's a problem with what I'm saying. And often what people are trying to learn is how to actually do it in the, you know, do it speaking, talking to, you know, so that. But I do want to handle what you said. When I was an actor and I was being taught how to do monologues, my original guess as a young kid was, oh, if it's a monologue, I have to imagine I'm Hamlet. I have to imagine my father's been killed. I have to imagine,
right. Okay?
And I would then get up and do this monologue. And an astute acting teacher told me very early on, that's not enough. Even though you're alone, even though it's a monologue, you have to imagine someone you're saying it to. You have to experience it as a dynamic exchange or it won't be alive. That even when, so that's acting and that's monologue. But I think what I'm saying is, I think what it says is that the writer, when writing, is going to resonate more deeply with his audience if, when he's writing, he's not just putting out, you know, it's not just, I take this thing and I move it forward. It's that he is imagining the audience. He is imagining that this is, that he is imagining the reader. He is imagining this as a dynamic experience rather than, as I say, a static one.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Now I see you a little more clearly. Yeah, I think that's absolutely so. It's certainly, you know, even when I'm, you know, writing something, it's a constant question about how is the audience going to take this? How are they going to react to this? Am I boring them? Am I going on too long? So there's a constant sort of calculation of what the effect on an audience is going to be, because you're always trying to produce an effect in an audience.
That's right.
You know, an emotional, an intellectual, sort of response. You know, in a book like I'm doing, you're trying to, you know, move them emotionally a little bit. You're trying to,
I think one thing you're doing is trying to keep them curious. So is it worth reading the next chapter?
Absolutely. Yeah, you have to be continually, one thing is, like, you know, the novelist Ian McEwan has said that so much of the art of the novel comes down to the artful withholding of information. So you're always holding back a little bit. Even in a nonfiction book, you're trickling out the information in a way that's going to leave the audience sort of yearning for that next page, yearning for the surprise that's coming, yearning for the payoff that's coming.
I will share with you that Michael Lewis,
yes,
who is it's interesting. Both Ira Glass and Malcolm Gladwell say he's their favorite contemporary storyteller. Right, So. I was talking to Michael, interviewing Michael, and asked him sort of what makes a great story, right? And he said what you just said, McEwan said. He said, as I have gotten better, one of the things I think is that I take more things out. He says it's like that game what I forget the name of it. Tetris, is that what it's called?
Where
you remove things and you try to leave it standing with this while taking out the blocks. He says that
Jenga, right?
Jenga. And what he says is that is what he thinks, you know, really good writing is that how much can you take out?
Right.
So that the audience has to fill it in. The audience has to play a role in it. That's when the real good writing is happening.
That's very good. That's very much in keeping with what you were saying too.
Yeah. And it's interesting that one writes fiction, one writes nonfiction.
It's all storytelling.
Exactly.
You know,
exactly.
It's all storytelling, yeah.
Yeah. Now, I hope you've done a little bit of looking at this one. There's some very mixed information these days about combining story and data.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Now, intuitively, to me, it feels that backing up a compelling story with a memorable piece of data adds to its power. You know, okay, it's not just one anecdote. This is, and vice versa. A compelling story find a great piece of data. Now you tell a compelling story and it's no longer just, you know, information. It's got some heart to it. Okay.
Right.
I, hear a lot that in terms of engagement and persuasion, data plus story is less effective than story by itself. And I've actually read some of the research. I suspect that the fact that a few studies have debunked what otherwise seems commonsensical, that, wow, data plus story must be better than just, you know, one by itself, that people have grabbed that and run with it. And so the light is all shining on that one because it's counterintuitive. Have you done any research on this and what do you know about it?
Well, first off, I kind of agree with you. I really feel like figures and facts and data mixed in with the story just make it work better. Maybe not in a novel necessarily, but certainly in when it comes to sort of educational reading. So somebody like Malcolm Gladwell or Lewis, you know, these guys are just masters of telling stories, but also lacing it with really sort of meaty data. We like both things. And I'm holding in my hand, as you were talking, this happened to be right at my desk.
Okay.
I am holding Volume 2, Issue 1 of the 2012 volume of The Scientific Study of Literature. And on page 37, Melanie Green has written an article called Emotion and Transportation into Fact and Fiction. And basically what this is showing, one of her results in the study is that whether you shape... it's showing that, you know, this belief change from storytelling that we talked about earlier.
Right. That fiction is more persuasive than nonfiction.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. But what if you take a nonfiction data material and you put it into story form? Then does it become just as persuasive as fiction storytelling? And basically, this study shows that it does just about as good a job. So if you tell a good story that's based on nonfiction that includes fact in it, it has as much persuasive appeal as a straight fiction-based story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the one study that I looked at was where they gave students, they told them they were testing them on one thing, but they were really testing them on something else, right? That's common. And what they told them was fill out some things on, computer information, and then we'll give you $5. And when they gave them the $5 at the end, they also gave them a letter from, it was from Save the Children. And in one set of kids got a picture and a story about an individual child, and the other one got data about statistics about food shortages, lack of rain, dislocation of millions, etc. And people gave more of that money. As the suggestion was, you know, you've just got this $5. Would you like to give some to Save the Children? People gave more money when they got the story and the picture than when they got the data. Then they did a one where they put the two of them together, and still they didn't get as much as when they just had the story and the picture. What? My sense was that they gave them too much data.
That's what I'm wondering too. It would depend sort of on the quality of the storytelling, right?
Exactly, and the quality of the data telling.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And that's where I think this study that sort of, you know, it's the big one that a lot of people look at. I think it went wrong in that, you know, give me one crushing statistic that makes that one little girl more than one little girl, and
exactly.
I don't think it hurts.
No. I mean, again, this is kind of what I do for a living.
Yeah.
I write stories that are sort of fact-based, and I lace them with the most rigorous research I can find. And I'm not alone in doing this. And basically, there's sort of a structure to this, too. There's a grammar to it, too. There's a formula that a lot of us are following, sort of, you know, this Gladwellian or Michael Lewis-like structure. And the key to it seems to be to tell good stories. But no one just wants the story. I mean, you're not going to have any influence or any pull with readers because they know that you can't always just trust anecdotes.
Yeah.
You know, they know anecdotes don't make a science, and so they want some sort of statistical backing to what you're saying.
Yeah, I mean, the data says, oh, this isn't just one feel-good anecdote. Yeah, there's more going on here. Here's another one that's quirky. See if there's any science behind this. It's my experience that in good stories, the more specific the details, the more universal the engagement or resonance. You with me?
Mm-hmm. I'm with you. Yeah, I would certainly agree with that.
Does that make sense to you? And what does science tell us anything about that?
I don't know anything about that. I know that, you know, when I teach writing classes sometimes, and when I ask my students, we try to like take stories and reverse engineer them. We sort of take them apart and say, okay, we know this is good writing. We know this had a powerful emotional effect on us. Why? What was it about it that made it work so well? And the students take it apart. And almost invariably, the first thing they leap upon is this sort of specificity of detail. They like that they were able to smell that world, feel that world, and touch that world. One of the things they like is a very authentic virtual reality experience.
Mm-hmm.
And so much of the art of fiction comes down to producing that sense of verisimilitude, that sense of authenticity. I just feel like the more specific the detail is, the more vivid the detail is, the more you're actually able to put yourself in that world.
Yeah. I mean, interesting stuff. So memory. I meant to talk about it. We've only got a few minutes. But obviously, one of the things I say about story is that story is how we remembered enough to survive until we came up with writing.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have anything about the relationship of story and memory?
Yeah. I mean, most of us think of our memories as very trustworthy, as very real and authentic. We sort of think of them as a videotape of our lives that we can sort of rewind and play back, and we can trust them. But when memory researchers started probing into this seriously about 20 years ago, they were shocked. They were truly shocked to find how vulnerable to contamination, to distortion, to corruption that videotape is. And they're not like random glitches. They tend to be predictable glitches. We remember things in a way that makes us more heroic, more, they're self-serving accounts of our lives. So to a large degree, the story of our lives as given to us by our memories have been sort of fictionalized or at least shaped in a way that allows us to be, you know, more of a heroic protagonist in our own life stories.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, but that's all based on a foundation that memory, that story does, it seems to me. I mean, I've read that the mind establishes a storyline and the recalling of one event triggers another, that if you want people to remember your facts, put them in a story.
Mm-hmm.
That part's true. And yet, what you're saying is that with our own memories, you checked it, there was that experiment with how people remembered 9/11. And then they asked them right afterwards, and they gave one account, and they asked them 2 years later, and the account had changed in almost every case.
Exactly.
It's wild. Yeah. So it helps us, story helps us remember, but it doesn't necessarily help us remember accurately.
Right. So, I mean, memory, there's this, I can't remember who I quoted, I think it was a novelist saying that memory serves many masters beyond truth.
Mm.
So memory serves truth, but it's also serving other masters. It might serve other purposes. If the purpose of memory is to help us to have a perfect sort of recall of what happened in our lives, then memory is a pretty crappy system. But if memories are something else, for helping us live better lives, perhaps the weaknesses of memory are actually strengths.
Okay.
The flexibility of our memories can actually be a good thing.
Okay, we're going to leave it at that. Again, the book is The Storytelling Animal. The website is jonathangottschall.com. I'm going to spell it J-O-N-A, T-H-A-N, Jonathan Gottschall, G-O-T-T-S-C-H-A-L-L, jonathangottschall.com. You can listen to this week's conversation and many others anytime during the week by linking to the podcast. You can do that at iTunes or at my website, which is terrencemcnally.net, T-E-R-R-E-N-C-E-M-C-N-A-L-L-Y.net, or aworldthatjustmightwork.com, one word. They're both the same site. You can sign up at iTunes or at my site to have it delivered to you weekly. You can sign up at my site or by emailing me at T-E-McNally@mac.com to get a weekly announcement telling you who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about, and two or three articles of background. And finally, thank you to Jonathan Gottschall. Keep up the good work.
Thanks, Terrence. It was fun being on your show.
Very good.